everybody. Welcome back to the 343 Sparkcast. We're back again, keeping the monthly release train rolling. This is three in a row. It's a big deal for me.
Seriously? Three
in a row.
Really?
June, July, and this will be August.
That's like a podcast.
Unless it releases in September, and then that's not my fault. If the internet drops down and we can't access it, I don't know. I'll call every one of you individually and record it for you. Anyway, we're here. If you're listening to this as soon as we record it, we're releasing the week of Halo Fest, which, of course, is a celebration of 10 years of Halo here in Seattle as part of PAX Prime. And I have a couple of guests with me. Of course, I'm David Ellis, content producer here at 343. And joining me, as always, is Frank O'Connor, Franchise Development Director. How you doing, Frank?
Not bad.
And seeing as we are celebrating the 10 years of Halo, we have a very special guest on this particular episode. We have Jamie Kreismer from formerly of Bungie, now at Sucker Punch.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Did I get your name right?
Yeah,
Kreismer. I'm the worst at doing names.
I've heard every possible permutation.
Kreismer.
And for those of you who don't know, first off, shame on you. Jamie is a longtime Bungie gent. Worked on Halo 1, Halo 2, Halo 3, basically throughout the entire franchise.
Yeah, yeah.
So we brought Jamie on to kind of talk about his experiences working more specifically on the first Halo and maybe answering some questions, tell some stories you may not have heard. I've been drilling him with questions already because I'm as big a nerd as anyone. But anyway, I guess just kind of kicking it off, can you talk a little bit about how you came to Bungie and then eventually came to work on what became Halo?
Yeah, I was running a website for Myth, which is an earlier Bungie game, while I was in college and getting my degree in physics, which turned out to be completely useless. And so I made contact with Max Hoberman, who was kind of doing your job back back then. He was running the website. And
It's funny. He started with the website as well. We talked to him a couple weeks ago. He told the story of how he was did a phone interview with Alex Seropian and completely lied to him and said he knew how to make a website, had never done anything website related at all, and basically spent an entire weekend learning how to make a website.
Well, it turns out there was a lot of deceit and con jobs going on, because basically what happened for me was I was running a Myth site, and I got in contact with Marty O'Donnell, who did the music for Myth 1, and asked him if I could do an interview. And, of course, if you know Marty, that's like, you know, something he cannot possibly turn down. So even for a tiny little insignificant Myth website. And one of the questions in my interview was, so are you doing the music for Myth 2, which had not been announced yet? And, of course, Marty said, yeah, they're, you know, I started working on the music. And so instead of running to the presses, I decided to extort Marty into giving me a tour and said, hey, you realize that Myth 2 hasn't actually been announced, and I'm sure you don't want me to announce it. So I'm right up the street. Maybe I can come in for a tour. And so I got a tour of Marty's studio, which was a few blocks away from the Bungie studio at the time. This is before it burned down, which I suspect was a way to get Marty over to Bungie by sabotaging his current setup. Is there some?
No, I was just imagining Marty's old studio full of like Moogs with cables everywhere, sparking.
It was a really,
it was all plugged into
really
one outlet
nice
in the
place.
Wall.
It was all built out in wood, and you had a pool table. It was fantastic. It
smelled of mahogany as you walked in the door.
Oh, absolutely. Cigars. Scotch. Anyway, so I parlayed the tour with Marty in his studio into a full tour of Bungie, and met a bunch of the guys over there. And then when they were looking for QA testers, which is what we used to call quality assurance. They were looking for cheapo college students to come in and play Myth 2.
We'll work for Cheetos.
Yeah, yeah. No, my interview at Bungie was literally, so will you work for $7.50 an hour? And I said yes, and they said you're hired. Nice. And that's so, yeah, it's significantly more difficult to get into the game industry today.
That's anyway. Still minimum wage now, right? Roughly.
Ballpark. Yeah, but now they have reality shows to become a tester.
Nice. Somebody's got to tighten up the graphics on level 3 before we ship this.
So what was your first role as just a QA tester?
Yeah. So I would come in after school or on the weekends, And then that lasted like almost a week. It turns out being a tester is super hard and not actually very much fun. So then I started testing the tools, air quotes, by making multiplayer maps. And that was how I got my foot in the door.
That's awesome.
And so then after Myth 2 shipped, I went into Alex Serpian, who was the CEO. I went into his office with my key fob that opened the doors, and I said, okay, I'm not giving this back. So I'm just going to keep hanging around until you give me another job. And they actually tried to ship me off to the Oni team. They sent me off to San Jose, and I interviewed there and failed terribly. They were not having it. They did not want me. And so I had to go work on the Halo team instead.
Oh, you poor bastard.
Yeah. No, it was rough. I avoided the second worst crunch in Bungie's history that way.
Victory from the jaws of defeat.
So you started working on the Halo. It wasn't called Halo, I'm assuming, when you started working on it. Was it still just Blam?
No, it was. Yeah, it was Blam.
Yeah. And was it still running on the Myth 2 engine, or had it moved over to the Blam engine at that point?
It was an evolving thing.
Yeah.
Pieces of it were constantly getting rewritten. But I mean, if you look in Halo 1's source code, there's stuff all the way back from Pathways.
Yeah. But it was definitely an RTS when you first started.
The first time I saw it was right after they made the switch. So they had a guy running around in third person, and he didn't look anything like the Master Chief. Yeah. And he was, shooting weapons that were nothing like the game weapons that shipped.
There's a piece of first person lore that I repeat all the time, because I heard it at Bungie when I first started, that was that Chucky just put the camera on the unit's head, basically, to tinker with that switch.
Yeah, you had a mode where you could select a guy and send him somewhere, and then the camera would just kind of trail along with him. And then there were parameters for changing where that camera was. And so, Charlie stuck it to the guy's head and then told him to go somewhere. And it was a pretty compelling view that you got.
It's interesting, because the way it's been described is when it moved from an RTS, or kind of one of the impetus for it moving, was the Warthog, and just driving around in the Warthog and messing around with that. So it seems like it went from macro to micro, from an RTS, which is big, you're looking at the whole world, to looking through the eyes of one person.
Yeah, you know, that's the story.
Yeah. What's the truth?
To be honest, I think Jason wanted to make another first-person shooter. I think he thought, we have this Myth engine, maybe we'll capitalize on it, maybe we'll go sci-fi, and then he just kind of got drawn inexplicably.
Judo'd it back to the form he preferred.
Yeah. And there was a couple stops along the way. There was the third-person view that we stuck with for a while, but I think almost as soon as the decision was made to go sci-fi, I think the first-person perspective was inevitable.
Yeah.
But you guys, I mean, ultimately, you weren't at that stage. You weren't doing the kind of problem solving that you had to do for a console. You were competing. I mean, definitely, you were going to be doing an open world sort of a shooter and a vehicle combat shooter and physics. We were looking at the physics earlier. The then amazing, but now sort of primitive physics based stuff. The things that make Halo really stand out, though, are the places where you had to sort of solve, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, solving for the things that happened after the switch from mouse and keyboard to joysticks. I mean, that must have been a fairly big philosophical shift in what you guys had to do design-wise from what you would have had to do if it was just a mouse and a keyboard.
Yeah, it was. That was definitely the first big challenge that we ran into when we moved out to Seattle and knew that we were developing for the Xbox. We knew that if we couldn't get the input to the point where you could control the game much better than any shooter had done on a console before, then we weren't going to be able to have the combat that we wanted. The AI wasn't going to be able to be as sophisticated. We certainly couldn't raise the bar to where we wanted it.
Because if you guys were, if GoldenEye controls were the extent of what you were able to do, the AI would need to kind of not move as much laterally so that you can kind of run in straight lines and shoot them. Or what are some of the...
Yeah, and even just GoldenEye controls are extremely difficult to be precise with.
Because you
can turn, but you can't really aim in the vertical that much. And so headshots would have been out. And even something like a rocket launcher, which you don't think of being as precise as a sniping weapon, you need to be able to aim at the ground,
right,
in a specific place. And so looking up and down was a big deal. And that's why when we first came out to Seattle, the first thing we did was we started running usability tests on games that had come out for the PlayStation 2. I think we ran a bunch of tests on Time Splitters,
yeah,
and GoldenEye, and tried to set it up. You could kind of hack the Time Splitters controls so they were something similar to what we were planning for Halo. And so we ran a bunch of people through that and to see what the issues we were going to
face. Yeah, I never really thought about that, but you bring up an interesting point, which was that FPS games to that point had played on basically a single plane, on consoles, I mean. And I mean, I remember playing games like Power Slave and stuff like that, where you'd hold down a button to strafe and circle strafe. And it was just, but that required that you could only shoot on a horizontal plane. I'd never really considered that before.
Well, it actually reflects something that goes back a lot further in Bungie's past, where Doom is primarily flat. You know, your shots will go up and shoot somebody above you, but you don't actually have to aim at them.
Yeah, it wasn't until Quake that they actually moved into kind of the vertical space.
Well, it wasn't until Marathon.
Yeah. But for them,
and so Marathon, you know, technically it wasn't the first game to do vertical aiming, but it was Bungie's first game to do it, to do vertical aiming. And so we were already kind of familiar with how important it was and how much of a difference it made in Marathon.
Yeah.
And so we knew that was going to be a priority.
Did you have any PC purist, PC Glorious Master Race people who were like against the auto aim?
Yeah, actually, the people writing the auto aim code were PC elitists who were very much against the sort of auto. So just to kind of clarify the term, so auto aim is what we call the post-shooting fix-up, where you didn't really shoot the guy, but because we know it's hard, because our controls aren't very good, we'll make the bullet hit where you intended to shoot.
Yeah, and you can sort of predict intent by what's going on.
Yeah, so. And that's that had been kind of the paradigm up until Halo, where people would just accept the fact that you weren't going to be as accurate, and so we'll just help you. Aim assist is more what Halo has, and that is helping the player get their crosshair where they want it to be, and then not actually fixing up the bullets after they leave the gun. So instead of the kind of snap to stuff that you were seeing in previous games like Time Splitters has, you would slow down the crosshair when it was crossing over enemies. We had a lot of code in there to help you keep the crosshair on a guy, but you still had to do it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't going to do it automatically.
So in essence, just putting more, at least perceived control in the hands of the player while they're playing the game. So they feel like they're doing it rather than the game doing it for them. Is that kind of the intent?
Yeah. Yeah. And that came directly out of being a bunch of PC snobs who weren't going to accept this auto aim solution. And so we had to come up with something that gave us more control.
So you talked about the move to Seattle. What was the first time that you guys internally got your hands on kind of an Xbox development kit to start figuring out what you had to work with?
You can be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. So we started getting dev kits while we were still in Chicago. And I was smiling because they actually looked like Mac towers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They still did up until the 360. The first dev kits for the 360 were G5. Like Mac.
Yeah, I guess
I have one in my house.
Well, that's what that was.
The story, and it may be apocryphal, is just that Microsoft got their hands on a bunch of cases for really, really dirt cheap and just decided to use them. Yeah. So we had started, so we knew what the specs were going to be. And so, and it wasn't actually that much different than what we got on a PC at the time. So
what was it roughly?
It was a modified like Pentium 3, like 777 megahertz.
It was NVIDIA or ATI?
It was NVIDIA.
NVIDIA first time ATI second.
Yep.
Yeah. And the hardware was one thing, but the real limiting factor for us getting started on development was the controllers. The first batch of Xbox dev kits shipped with these.
It was like a Sidewinder, the original Sidewinder.
Really cheap. Terrible controllers that weren't at all what the Xbox controller ended up being.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you guys have a lot of input in how the controller ended up, or were you adapting the game to adhere to the new controller specs as they kept rolling in?
Oh, absolutely. We had a lot of influence. One of the reasons why Microsoft was interested in Bungie was because they needed consumers for their hardware team that were internal to the company that could come and start putting pressure on their internal teams to produce something that you can make a game with. And so we were situated right down the street from the hardware guys, and we eventually even moved right across the parking lot from them.
Yeah.
And so we would go over there all the time and test prototypes and give them feedback.
Yeah. I mean, that definitely became very apparent during Halo 2 with matchmaking, was working very directly with the platform to not only help things get pushed through, but create things from scratch and have them rolled into the overall effort. So Xbox Live is... In the way it was on Xbox One, a lot of that was stuff that came straight out of Halo.
Yeah,
it was really visible. So.
Yeah, Bungie was just ravenous for resources, and that I think helped the Xbox guys up their game a lot. So it wasn't just kind of the external stuff like matchmaking and the controller, but even internal things like their playtest labs. We used the playtest lab probably 10 times more than the nearest other game during the original Xbox One development time. A lot of the tools that Bungie developed for their own internal use got polished up and rebranded and sent out to external teams as part of the dev kits.
Kind of moving along the kind of line of moving from PC to the Xbox One. Obviously, scoping was probably a big part of moving it, or had the game changed at that point to become more of what we think of when we play Halo from the kind of the original intent, the kind of third person. Had it moved to first person before that point, or
it
after
had,
that point?
It had, yeah, we had decided it was going to be a first-person game before the acquisition. And so much of the other stuff that people assume about where Halo was at before we got acquired was speculation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't really have a plan for how we were going to do missions, and we didn't have an AI. And there were so many things that hadn't been decided yet that probably would have been decided the exact same way if we'd continued on and developed for PC. It's just the natural way that games kind of evolve.
And there weren't a lot of people when Bungie moved from Chicago to Redmond, right? It was like 29 core staff on the Halo team.
Yeah.
Plus Oni people as well who were coming. Did those people come straight from San Jose to Redmond?
No. Well, yes, they did, but they didn't come at the same time.
Yeah.
They came
As they finished up,
Oni shipped. Yeah.
So, I mean, you were playing earlier B30, Silent Cartographer.
Yeah.
You said it was the first space that was created within the kind of first mission. It's kind of the test bed for sort of everything that you guys were trying to do with the game.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about how the space kind of came to be, like this island in the middle of nowhere and...
Yeah.
Kind of what was the thinking behind that?
Yeah. Silent Cartographer, which I'll try not to call B30 because people are starting to learn what those code names were, but it still can confuse people. We needed a space that could prove out a bunch of the assumptions we were making, especially about the engine. And so an island in the middle of nowhere is great because there isn't anything to render in most of the directions. And so you can do visibility really well. And so if you look at B30 from a top-down perspective, it's sort of a circular island with a bunch of kind of canyons cut into it.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the canyons can see the other canyons. And so you never have to draw more than one or two of them at any given time. And so the structure of that environment was almost entirely determined by rendering. And then we made it into a circle because we wanted a very freeform atmosphere where you could go wherever you wanted, but we didn't want you to be able to get lost. And in a circle, you can't get lost. If you keep going one direction, eventually you'll arrive at where you're supposed to go. And then we knew that exteriors were going to be important, but first-person shooters at the time were almost exclusively indoors. And there's a reason for that. It's because interiors have lots of cover. They have lots of really tight connectivity, small little loops you can run in. And so combat tends to be better in indoors. So we knew we wanted some indoors. And at that point, it was easy just to say, okay, well, we'll just plop some entrances into an interior around the island, and then we'll just make these stacks of combat encounters.
And that's still true for a lot of FPS games now, is they still – I mean, if you look at a top-down map of certainly Halo 3 and Halo Reach levels and a lot of other competitor shooters, you're looking at, effectively, forgetting the graphics, you're looking at a tunnel, a bowl, a tunnel, a bowl, and so on. And that's how they change up the pacing of the level, and that's how you switch from shooting where you're looking, because that's where you're running, to the sort of, like, you certainly think of Truth and Reconciliation, right, sniping across a swathe of things, but you're always doing it in kind of a bowl, regardless of what the actual geology is like, and that's still true. I mean, that's still the basic structure for most things, Call of Duty, Halo, a lot of other shooters.
Yeah, and I think that one of the reasons why Silent Cartographer turned out so well was because it was designed from a visibility and navigation perspective first, and then we had to retroactively put a story on it.
Yep.
So the story of Silent Cartographer is nonsense. It's like, for some reason, Cortana needs something from somewhere, and so you have to go to this island.
You have to go down to a dead end, stare at an angry elite through the glass.
Yeah, and then we made up these reasons for you to have to go to all the different interiors. But people don't really notice because they're having so much fun just exploring the environment.
But that's okay. I mean, that's a gaming convention. You know, movies have conventions that don't make much more sense than order to fit in 2.5 hours, right? And I was watching Jon Favreau talking about Halo.
Oh, yeah.
That YouTube video yesterday. And he's like, you know, the actual game stories aren't sort of filmable as they stand, but often the games have lots of great foundational elements for universes and stories. And mm-hmm. kind of, you know, if you ever want to do something different with a game's universe, you should do something different and not try to slavishly copy the game story, because the story works for the gaming conventions. Like, Pokemon has a story that works for Pokemon's gaming conventions.
Yeah.
So
gotta catch them all.
You have.
That's
it.
I
mean, I know that, right? That's the hero's journey.
Yeah. I've never touched a Pokemon game.
I have,
for the record.
I'm confused about them.
Not true.
Well, you're waiting for the movie?
Actually, I'm waiting for presidential candidates to keep playing Pokemon theme songs.
David exclusively plays Halo and Sonic games. Every single Sonic game, Sonic Pinball, Sonic Spinball. Yeah.
If anyone knows me, we were a Nintendo family growing up, so we never played Sega. But that's how it used to be. It was like you
Red
one
State
or the other.
Family. Yeah. I don't know.
But another component that you talked about a little bit before is, and that's so incredibly important for the first Halo, is the AI.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk a little bit about because you used B30 as kind of the test bed for that as well, especially the beach encounter.
So the beach encounter was a really important encounter because it was the first kind of moving front fight that we had, and that was all done completely explicitly. Like, there's nothing reactive about that at all. It's just the script is saying, hey, as soon as this number of guys are dead, the Covenant will fall back and the humans will move forward. And that's how we had to do it in mm-hmm. Halo 1. It became much more sophisticated in subsequent games as we took that model and then kind of made it algorithmically possible in the AI. But in that first game, it was pretty tightly controlled. But the encounter that has probably been recreated more times than any other encounter in the entire franchise is the fight at the sort of diving board mm-hmm. entrance to the main shaft. Mm-hmm. And that was the first encounter that got built, and we would have to build it by you'd have to run your character around and then hit the space bar to kind of poop out the firing points and the spawning locations and stuff. So, you know, it took 2 days to put all the information in there, and then Chris Butcher, the AI programmer, would change something about the AI, and I would have to do it all over again. So
the tools are exactly the same.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think they just click a button, which is like build encounter, and it all happens automatically. But back in the day, it was a time consuming, exhausting process. But what that meant was that whereas usually in game development, you make an encounter, and then maybe you get to revise it one time, and then you got to move on to the next one because you have so much going on. The encounters on Silent Cartographer just got built over and over and over, so they got iterated on and iterated on and iterated on. By the time they shipped, they were really, really sophisticated to a level that a lot of the other encounters in Halo 1 and even in subsequent games didn't get the time and iteration. Yeah.
But, you know, I don't, it's not something I notice. I mean, definitely Silent Cartographer feels more like a set piece because in a way it is. You're landing, it's a beach invasion, blah, blah, blah. But I never really got the feeling after that the encounters had been, you know, any more or less phoned in. They always felt like it was the same game, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I did find refreshing about Halo was probably, and I'm probably just describing crunch issues as I describe this, there will be scenes where I am in a Warthog on my own driving with nothing happening for a really long time. An amount of time right now that would cause certainly our designers and probably Bungie's designers to have a panic attack because nothing had happened. But that's one of the best things about the game for me in campaign right now, especially since the anniversary is a remake. And what I want to do is go on a tour, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a museum piece, and I want to just explore at my own pace. And I sometimes think that, especially in a sandbox game, that's fine. Just leave a piece of it alone. It's fun to drive this vehicle, or it's fun to fly this flying vehicle, or it's fun just to walk around and explore. And I kind of miss that from the olden days. But it's probably just a legacy of not having enough time to fill everything with all the encounters that you want to do.
And when you're hopped up for 72 hours on like 64 bottles of game fuel, you need action and you need it every moment.
Yeah, I guess I'm really old. I don't need the ADD constant, you know, monster closets every 10 seconds.
It's players are much less patient than they were even in the days of Halo 1. As you test a game more regularly and earlier in the process, you start to get that feedback pretty early of, I feel like I'm lost. I feel like nothing is happening for a while. And especially in sequels to the Halo games, you sort of have had a lot of the story revealed. You understand the characters better. The plot is putting more time pressure on you. Mm-hmm. And so, things that worked in the very first few levels of Halo just wouldn't have worked, you know, halfway through Halo 3. And I think that's how you see the kind of change in pace and everything. But it is the case that pacing in Halo 1 was largely accidental. And then subsequent Halo games have tried to recapture elements of that intentionally. And sometimes it's just easier to luck into it.
I mean,
accidental inspiration is difficult in some ways. Frank, I'm glad you brought up the kind of the sandbox, because I want to talk about, you know, when you're playing first-person shooter is a big part of it, and what do you shoot? You shoot the guns and the weapons and how it interacts with melee, grenades, things like that. It's always been a huge part, and especially Halo 1 kind of establishing the vocabulary for kind of what makes a sandbox shooter going forward. At what point did you guys internally even start referring to it as like a sandbox, or was that something that was always there, or... How did this kind of vocabulary of just describing the kind of interaction between guns to grenades to melee and all that stuff?
I'm smiling because you realize I've given multiple hour-long presentations on tiny, insignificant details.
Yeah, TLDR.
But Halo, as you know, as I saw yesterday at GDC, you only got 16 words now.
I don't. I'm gonna have to abridge my talk titles now.
But I guess at what point for me, like playing the older first-person shooters and stuff, the guns, it was mostly just picking up a gun, and I never really thought about the interaction of the different guns and how they kind of fit into a larger kind of sandbox. It was more of a, I'm just going to grab this gun, then get a bigger gun that takes up more of my screen and blows up more stuff, then get a bigger and bigger and bigger gun. Mm-hmm. And that tended to be the way it played in other games, and Halo's not the case. It kind of goes in the opposite. You have your rocket launcher, you have your sniper rifle. But more often than not, I'm just going to grab that pistol and use it.
Yeah. You definitely see in earlier shooter games, there's a sequence of guns that get more and more powerful that you get later and later in the game. And the ammo is scarcer and scarcer, and they do more and more damage. And I would say that the main reason why Halo diverged from that formula was time. So if you look at some of the design docs for Halo 1... We seriously had to consider cutting the shotgun. I mean, it was that bad time-wise. And so if you're only going to get 5 weapons, mm-hmm. and you're only going to get 6 enemies and maybe 3 vehicles, only one of which is going to be really solidly polished, you can't build that sort of progression. You can't build that stack of 15 weapons that procedurally get better. And you need variety in your game. So you need to be able to use every weapon against every enemy in every kind of environment.
And have it feel meaningfully different each time.
Yeah, and have it feel interesting. And so that kind of combination mentality was a result of just mathematically, you get a lot more variety if you can combine everything with everything else.
So how did that thinking affect the bad guys? Because as soon as you said that, I'm thinking, well, I think of the way that the sandbox weapon set works against the Flood, especially. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Covenant's super well understood, I think. But the Flood it feels like an exception, and it almost feels like a set piece, and it's a repeated set piece. But that feels like almost an expression of what can I do with the shotgun, right? Can I burst things? That's how it always felt to me.
Uh-huh. The Flood existed before the shotgun damage. I mean, whatever. Zombies and shotguns go together really well. But the doing lots and lots of damage against the Flood was a way that we could make the shotgun feel differently against the Flood than against the Covenant. And so we were always looking for – or plasma weapons are very bad when you use them against the Flood. And that's another way that we can combine them in different ways. But, if you look at the Flood – they can carry every weapon in the game. Mm-hmm. And that's because we could have developed a Flood that had their own specific weapon that every time you fought the Flood, you were going to get that specific weapon shot at you. But then it would have been kind of samey in OneNote. But since we could give the Flood anything, then you get a lot of different variety. And all of a sudden, the Flood will whip out a rocket launcher and blow
you up.
That's
exactly this. Yeah, you're like a nasty surprise.
And really, before Halo, you don't expect – when you come across the zombies, A, you expect them to be walking slow if you were raised on kind of Night of Living Dead. But you don't expect them to be able to use weapons. So the first time they shot at me, I was a little confused. I was like, where's the Covenant asshole shooting me from the top?
The Flood was the first water cooler twist conversation I ever had about a video game. And I was working in video games at the time, right? And we play video games all the time. It wasn't like we were short of video game surprises. But I'd been on a business trip, and so I'd missed the day where you're supposed to play through campaign. And everyone was about halfway through the campaign in the morning, and they're saying, have you seen the Flood? And they said the Flood. And I was like – and then when they found out I hadn't, they just clammed up. So I was expecting a water effect. I really was. And I was like, I was super excited because I love video game water. So, but the way it's presented and then the way it happens, it was the first time there'd been kind of a, you know how you go see a movie when you're a kid and you come and you talk about, and then Conan punched a camel in the face. It was awesome. And it was that conversation. It was the first time I'd seen it about a video game.
The Flood was actually, just calling them that was pretty interesting. I mean, I don't know if people really realize the number of biblical references in the Halo games. Yep. I mean, it's called Halo, right? And that just so naturally fit because it is a catastrophic disaster. It is what essentially wiped out civilization, but it's not water.
Yeah. Right. And they keep moving in waves.
It is juicy.
Juicier and juicier every time you've encountered them.
Yeah, we in Anniversary, Jamie played a little bit of Anniversary before we started, but the library level in particular was one of the idea is make sure the gameplay is exactly the same, but this was an easy opportunity to just go in and like not fix little things but change little things so that when you did use the back button, there is sometimes a compelling difference, and the library is a good example. You play it in classic mode is exactly the same. It's like, I'm terrified, I'm confused, blah, blah, blah. You play it in Anniversary mode, and now there's lighting, and it's easier to see Guilty Spark, just little things like that. Mm-hmm. And so now it plays much more like it played when you go through it first time, it plays how experts enjoyed it anyway, because they were like, no, I love the library because I can get a shotgun and hole up on
especially
a thing.
Especially co-op.
Yeah, so it's
frankly, it probably plays more similarly to how it played before we shipped. Because originally the library was actually kind of an open level. Mm-hmm. There's a center shaft, and it used to be all of the level looked out onto the center shaft, so you could see the index all the time, and it was pretty brightly lit for being supposed to be a creepy level. Yeah. But then toward the end of the game, we were having huge performance problems, and we had to kind of cap it off.
Close off the draw distance.
So then
is that because you had so many units running around in there, or just the geometry?
That was part of it. And you know, it's sort of the opposite of the silent photographer situation, where instead of everything looking out onto empty ocean, everything looks out onto everything
geometry,
else, which is maybe not the best plan.
Yeah. But the 343 Guilty Spark is another example of where there's a definitive change, because the fog was definitely there for atmosphere. I mean, you could draw that distance in the Halo engine. But we changed it for a kind of a hazy, rainy, it feels really damp, actually, but it's not literally fog. And we were talking about that on one of the forums yesterday, and they're like, I wish they had the fog back. And we're like, that is one of the places where we want you to press back and have there be a difference where it still feels scary, but in a really different jungly way than the foggy Dagobah version did.
Well, the fog at the end was to cover up the fact that there's only like three or four guys out there shooting at you and chasing you.
Or a grunt killing itself for no reason.
Yeah.
But it actually works. That's probably my favorite level to switch.
That's one of my favorite levels, period. Not because I think it turned out particularly well, but because of its development history, where I think every level designer on the entire team ended up working on that for some period of time, and it kept getting handed off, and I got it maybe 2 months before we were supposed to be completely done, and I had 3 weeks to rip it apart and put it back together again, and that was one of those, okay, I'm going to put on my headphones and nobody talk to me for the next 3 weeks because I have a lot of work to do.
Was it kind of the reason so many people worked on it? Was it kind of the problem child? Was it just difficult to kind of wrap what kind of made it interesting? Because you switch right in the middle of the level from the way you've been playing the game up to that point till after? Or was the flood always in that level?
It was sort of a difficult level to wrap your head around from a mission design perspective, because it's not really a mission. It is entirely a story experience. From the beginning, anytime you're fighting guys, it's just to set up the fact that, well, the Covenant doesn't seem to be as strong as they used to be, or why are they so scattered?
Why are they running? Yeah. What are they running from?
Yeah. And so it's tough to do an encounter that's simultaneously challenging, but at the same time is telling the story of that level.
It's good timing in your gameplay experience. It's hard for us to reset our gameplay experience, but I remember playing it and thinking, you know, I'm good at running and jumping now, and I'm good at looking around now, and I can kind of enjoy the level in that way as I'm more agile as I make my way through it. So, you know, running across tree trunks and shooting things that were under me or shooting things that were above me by that point was like, this is 10 years ago, but it was really instinctive by that point. So it's kind of, the timing was good for that level anyway.
You talked a little bit about things being potentially cut, not cut, you know, from Halo. We all know the story of Halo 2. And the crunch level on that one, but for this first game, there's always the story of the pistol and when it was tuned the way it was. There's a story about
pistol.
That.
Deliberate,
like, yeah,
accident, or combination of both.
David, I can tell you, you're sort of new to the gaming industry, to this side of the gaming industry, because game developers do not ask each other about things that were cut, horrible mistakes that were made, balancing problems. I appreciate your background, and I understand where this question is coming from. I have so many
responses on Twitter for questions to ask, and that's one of the bigger ones, the pistol.
The pistol. I mean, the way that the pistol plays in single player is how it was intended to play. Right. It's supposed to be accurate. It's supposed to do headshots. It's supposed to feel like a sledgehammer in some ways, especially against elites and grunts. In multiplayer, the pistol is much, much more powerful than it was in single player. And that's one of the only weapons that changes between single player and multiplayer. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it does that is because someone who will not be named played multiplayer very, very close to the end of the project. And I won't say panicked, but made an executive decision to go in and just double the damage, like literally double the damage, and do so in such a way that you couldn't even like undo it.
So scorched earth game tweak.
Yeah, the way that we normally would balance weapons in Halo as a designer was we had a tool and you go in and it was sort of like a version of Excel where you could see all the values and you could change them, and then it would get built into what we call a cache file, which is optimized to get read off the disk really fast. But you can't inspect it. You can't read it. So you can't change the cache file directly. Well, this unnamed person changed the cache building process so it automatically doubled the damage on the pistol. And so you couldn't even – you could look at the tags and read it and say, well, this should not be doing that much damage. And then you'd build the cache file and all of a sudden it would be way more
powerful. So did they sneak the cache file change into the build as a method to prevent interfering?
No, I think it happens. Was it just – it happened so late in the process that we were afraid of rebuilding cache files constantly. Mm-hmm. Because anytime you do that, there's a infinitesimally small risk that maybe something will get messed up and maybe you won't catch it in time. And so we actually weren't being allowed to change the cache files anymore. So this was a very illicit change.
People love the pistol and I love the pistol. But if you put that in matchmaking and it had been across Xbox Live when that game launched, I don't think people would have thought of it as fondly as they do.
I
guarantee. When it's in System Link and it's your buddy.
I guarantee when it's somebody that you can smack across the room, that's one experience, right? Because that guy is probably not that much better at Halo than you.
It's also the honor system, too, when you're sitting there and when you're playing at someone online that you don't know.
First few weeks, we didn't know why we were dying on Blood Gulch. The only guy in our office who'd figured it out, and this was before you could go, honestly, to GameFAQs and find this stuff out, and we had, I think, a couple of weeks before it was available to retail. We had no idea what was going on. All we knew was that the only time we could ever beat this guy, Dave Reese, is if we got the sniper rifle on Blood Gulch. And for some reason, he was able to kill us all the time. And we were thinking, oh, is it ping? Is it? And we just didn't realize that he was just using the default gun.
You could be in a tank and you could take it down.
That's how I used to take out tanks. That was the easiest way, just shoot him in the face. You know? And we didn't. I mean, it was fun on System Link, and it could be fun again. Who knows? But on Xbox Live, I think that would have had a completely different reputation if it had.
Yeah, and I completely understand why people like it, because amongst players of relatively equal skill, it's the weapon that you can use a tiny edge in skill to beat somebody.
Yeah,
and that's why kind of. Your average player likes it. That's why the super pro players like it. But if you put the average players and the super pro players in the same environment and then give them that weapon, it becomes a bloodbath.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, I definitely think of Call of Duty this way. One of the reasons that I, as a mediocre player, and Dave can attest to that, enjoy Call of Duty is that if I get the drop on someone in Call of Duty, I win, right? Yeah. I mean, if I'm behind them and I've got any gun, basically, I win. Mm-hmm. Halo, not the case. If I got the drop on an MLG player in a game of Halo, I could hit him, you know, three times in the body with the DMR, and then I would start because I'm not good enough to go for one headshot. Then I'd start going for the last two headshots, right?
Yeah.
He would turn around and
Three of us got the drop on that guy, then
he would turn around and just do stuff to us that didn't even make sense, right? And but I think that a lot of players now, certainly pro players, certainly really hardcore players, they actually enjoy that skill gap. Some players would rather win a game 50-10 than 50-48. Whereas I would much rather be 50-48. To me, that's excitement. But some people just want to dominate, right? That's what they get out of the game and they enjoy that, and that's fair enough.
So I'm kind of in that camp, and the reason it is because when I get home at night, I get stressed playing competitive games. And if I'm going to win, I want to win. I don't want to be like – that's one of the reasons over the time, I used to love objective games, capture the flag. But as time goes on, I'm much more just a slayer guy because I feel much more in control of what's going on.
But if you're dominating, then you're mismatched. You may as well go into kindergarten and start playing dodgeball with them.
You haven't tried it. It's really satisfying.
Yeah, I know. I've been one of those kids in the kindergarten every time I'm in Team Slayer. So.
Well, that's why the first couple weeks after a game ships are the best.
Yeah.
You've been playing the game for 3 years.
Not anymore, Reach was the nadir for me, right? Yeah. Like Halo 1, I played it a couple of weeks before other people, so I'd go to System Links. It was great. Halo 2, dominating for like 3 weeks. Halo 3 dominated for a week because they'd had the beta.
Yeah.
Halo Reach got dominated immediately by hardcore players who understood Bloom just instinctively better than I ever will even.
And it had been communicated much more thoroughly.
And people know what to loop like, and they have jargon, and they talk about skill gap, and they talk about connection gap. And
I feel like that's another reason why Halo 1 holds kind of a special place for a lot of people is because it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if Halo came out today, you'd have to talk about the blood. You would have to talk about everything up until the very last moment of the game would be in preview articles before you even got a chance. And so that sense of exploration and discovery and
unknown.
And the unknown just wouldn't be there.
But the idea, I mean, we're talking about the pistol. We talk about Bloom and DMR and stuff. The idea of a skill weapon is still completely – it's ridiculous to me, to be perfectly honest. The simple question I would ask people who think that some weapons are skill weapons and some weapons aren't, they're noob weapons, is if I go into a match with just rocket launchers with the Ogre Twins, what happens to me? Do I get close because I've got a rocket launcher? No, exactly the same thing happens to me as the DMR. Everything is a skill weapon. I mean,
it's a different
plasma
skill.
Pistol is a skill. Yeah, they're different skills. And Halo is a sandbox.
Ultimately, the skill is using that right thumb to move the reticle on a head and hit the right index finger to pull the trigger.
That's the pistol skill. That's the DMR skill. But there's also the skill of being in the right place with the shotgun when somebody comes around the corner.
Oh yeah, and it's a great way for players who are otherwise going to have a role to play to go and play a role. Right? I mean, I can't ever out BR or out DMR a really good player. Mm-hmm. I can't. But it's funny, you're in a game of the pit on Halo 3. No matter what, even in really, really high-level matches, people still rush for that rocket launcher because they want to control it. Mm-hmm. And also, it's a choke point, right? But it's completely illogical for us all to do that. But it's like a magnet, that top corridor on pit.
Mine,
it's like
mine.
A place to go or get a couple of kills. So you just got to go there. So,
Well, let's take it back to Halo 1 a little bit.
Yeah. Okay.
You actually set it up perfectly. You talked about it kind of coming out of nowhere. I mean, anytime you've put years of your life into something, you have to have confidence that it's going to be good, or else why go through that effort, you know? But did you guys have any concept that it would break so big, but then just keep going?
Is reaching.
Oh, yeah.
I brought a prop here. This, which you can't see, is a summary of marketing research that happened prior to Halo being shipped. So marketing, Microsoft marketing department went to Europe and Asia and all over the US and let people play little parts of the game and then did surveys to figure out whether, like, basically how much money to invest
in. And didn't
want to
call it Halo, incidentally.
Well, yeah, you're jumping ahead here, but yeah, I mean, one of the primary points that these guys came back with was that both the Covenant and Halo were weak names. The Halo and Covenant names are weak. Consider changing the game title. Names either need to be explained or reduced in importance within the marketing of the game. So they didn't want us to call it Halo. They didn't want us to call it the Covenant.
When did you get this presentation? What was the date on it?
Let's see. This is October of 2000. So this is this is very, very late in the game.
Yeah.
And one of their main reasons was that it's hard for the Japanese to pronounce.
Hey,
so I think actually we should have changed the name. We probably would have sold a lot more copies in Japan.
Yeah. You should have called it Space Killers.
You know, I actually have the Japanese copy of Halo here.
Yeah?
Yeah. I picked it up a couple years ago when I was in Tokyo for TGS, still shrink-wrapped.
Yeah.
There's kind of a falsehood. It's actually super easy for the Japanese to pronounce that word. They just pronounce it differently.
Yeah.
It's a very easy phonetic for them to pull off, and they replace L's with R's. That's a fact of the language. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I wore my second oldest Halo shirt today to get in the mood. but my oldest is a Japanese Halo shirt, and it never really fit. I mean, so I decided not to wear that one.
What kind of other stuff? Because this is a PowerPoint that it's amazing that you kept it. I love the fact that you kept it. I still have some stuff from this era as well.
Well, I mean, the very first line of the presentation is, this game has potential to be a solid performer. which I think they
that would be like, what, 150,000 units
or
something?
I think that's called sandbagging.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think they felt like they were doing us a big favor by saying, okay, it's got potential, but if you change the name and you change the main character and maybe change the story, then it will sell. but yeah, the, so they had this, they wanted to rename the Master Chief into the Commando. And so they were trying to say that the Commando is the strongest positioning for the game's hero. Actually, interesting story about how he got called the Master Chief. We were looking around for a name, and we didn't want to name him Stanley or something, right? We definitely didn't want him to have a last name.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of wanted him to be this archetype that you could step into and become the role. And so we knew he was part of the Navy. And so we just looked at a list of naval...
Yeah, the highest non-com
offices. Yeah. Well...
Officer rank.
The way it was described was, what is the highest rank you can achieve and still be considered expendable? And they wouldn't let a Spartan get higher than that.
It's pretty awesome.
And yeah, so that's why we started calling him Master Chief. And it's funny because, you know, that's his rank. That's not his name.
Right.
But people just kind of eventually...
He's the Master Chief.
Treated it as his name.
I bet Master Chief petty officers all over the Navy are pretty psyched about it. It's one of the most respected roles in the whole military because it is a non-com officer and it's the highest one in the whole Navy.
Absolutely.
So it's not like they had a bad rep before, but this just makes them a little more action-oriented, probably.
I went on the trip that Bungie took to Iraq when we were we took kind of pre-release copies of Halo 3 over there.
I was not allowed. Remember, they made us get permission from our wives if we wanted to go.
Oh yeah,
it was fairly soon after 9/11 in terms of the sort of real politic of the time. My wife said no.
Yeah,
we absolutely refused to let me go.
Yeah,
I was bummed.
Because it sounded awesome. I was dating the girl that eventually became my wife, but she didn't get a vote. Otherwise, she probably wouldn't have let me go.
Yeah. They had to sign something. It was literally a legal requirement, and she wouldn't sign it. I took it home. She wouldn't sign it.
Yeah.
So you got her drunk.
Or just angry.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, flip the bit.
Go ahead,
right? I'm already mad at you, but if I get so mad, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually called in favors to get to go.
But you guys actually, we're joking around, but you guys had to land hot in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right in Baghdad.
So I'm from Chicago and I fly back there. And when I fly into Midway. And Midway has kind of the shortest runways in the country that you're allowed to land a big plane on.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones in Iraq were way shorter. And the way that they approached them was they can't fly in over the countryside. They come almost straight down and then pull up and slamming in the ground.
Yeah. And just immediately you're hitting the air brake flaps all the way up.
Oh, yeah.
Everything in reverse. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I could talk about that trip all day. It was a really fantastic experience just to get to meet those guys and bring them some kind of element of home. And not even just here's something you could have gone to GameStop and played, but like here's something special. I remember there were guys that would – We set up a whole lab. I mean, it was like 32 Xboxes and TVs and copies of the game. And there's guys, they would come in and they would play and then they go out on a mission and then they come back and they play and they just, you know, prop their M16 up against the table, fully loaded, probably with a grenade launcher on it. And that was the thing that they were excited to get back to.
That's cool.
Yeah. Definitely one of the highlights of my Halo experience.
But you brought that story up when you were talking about officers.
Yeah, in the rank of the Master Chief.
Yeah.
Oh, right. So I ran into a Master Chief out there. And it was before – it was when we were still in Kuwait. And he grilled me on why we had called him that. And he actually was – he thought that we had picked an appropriate title, which we have some guys at Bungie, especially on the original Halo team, that were really you know, they had family members in the military. My brother was over there.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to be respectful and we wanted to do those guys right. And I hope that we did.
Yeah. And it's one of those ranks that's actually a tipping point in the military as well between the proper brass, the commissioned officers. There's a lot of commissioned officers who never, ever dare talk smack to a Master Chief.
Yeah.
We get, apart from just correct professional respect, it's the tipping point between the real men on the field and the office jockeys in a way, right? So that's not really true. Obviously, real officers are real combatants too.
Yeah.
But that's the feeling. It's like this guy represents the tip of that spear, and we're all in this together, and I've got to be nice to this guy because he can make your life hell.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There's a shirt that says "I am Master Chief." It was just like a promotional thing we gave away, I think, at E3 at one time, and I got like 5 of them. So I was wearing one to boot camp. It's like a workout thing, mm-hmm. and the guy running it is an ex-sergeant, and so he was like, "You were a Master Chief? I don't believe it!" And he was giving crap the entire time.
Never so wore that shirt wear it again.
You should have said, "You'll call me sir" when you ask me that question. Just that would have been the end of your bullying.
It would have been the end of my life, actually. Yeah. Another interesting thing that the marketing team came back with was that the game ought to be third person. Especially if we wanted to sell in Japan.
That's true.
We had a third person.
When we were at E3 and we did the turret
on Halo
Switch
3,
and the Halo 3 demo, we had an all-Japanese press conference once where it was all Japanese press and a couple of Korean guys. And we kind of knew they prefer third-person games. They prefer seeing a story than being a story. That's just a fact of their preference and narrative. But when we switched to turret mode, they literally were like, gasps of excitement and glee.
And then
everyone on the way out was like, "Can we do this all the time?" And we're like, "Well, you can do it every time there's a turret."
Yeah, you can try to carry a turret through most of the game, maybe.
Yeah, probably. So we did joke about doing
other than
Japanese
like
mod.
You know, changing the field of view, animation, all that stuff. What are some of the kind of the reasons that generally you stick to either first person or third person? Mm-hmm. Halo is sort of unique in that with vehicles in the first game and the turret in Halo 3 that you actually do switch between first and third person. Mm-hmm. Why would you never ship or why not allow people to switch between the two?
I think it comes back to that that precision that we desired. Whenever you're in third person, you have this problem where the bullets are not coming out of the same place as your camera is located. Mm-hmm. So you always have some kind of offset, and there's lots of ways you can fiddle around and cover it up. And there's some third person games that do a really good job, but you're never going to get quite as precisely. If you can see it, you can shoot it. And if you can't see it, you can't shoot it. And if you can't see it, it can't shoot you as in first person.
Most third person games slow the game down one way or another when they deal with precision aiming. So they either literally reduce the field of view, they literally reduce the speed of the game while you're shooting, or they do all sorts of sort of lock-on things that absolutely change. Gears is a good example. Like a lot of the precision weapons, there's a switch when you use them from what you're normally doing while you're running around to what you're doing when you're using the precision weapon. Well, because Halo is like flow and
the really precise weapons, they go into first person.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, looking down the scope.
Over the shoulder is effectively first person too. So there's like kind of three gradations of it. You got full third, over the shoulder, and then first. And I think Gears has all three, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
There's also, you know, there's a ton of issues of like when you're in third person, your character is covering up part of the guys that you're shooting at, and you know, there's a number of issues
with Halo as well. There were just weird animation and graphical things you would have had to deal with even if it worked.
Yeah, and I assume in the first one there would have been performance hits too because you are having to render that.
Oh yeah,
time and when you're in first person.
Well, first person, you still have to render the first person arms, which in Halo 1 had about the same number of polys as the Chief's model, so it would have been. Not too much of a rendering hit, but Bungie's philosophy is very much figure out the best way to do it and then do it that way, and don't just take the cop out and say, "Oh, we'll just give everybody the option to do whatever they want."
All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up here in a little bit. Was there anything else from the marketing?
Well, there's this one thing in here that I think maybe would apply to you guys going forward in Halo 4, which is exposed faces add empathy. So, you know, maybe consider, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, about showing the Chief's face.
One of her plans is to have him take his helmet off at the start of the game and continue to turn around and look at the camera and break the –
Zach Morris style.
Yeah. Yeah, perfect. Okay, good. I'm glad that you know
we're actually using this as our template for how to make Halo.
Yeah, could you leave that here?
Oh, absolutely. No, I'll just cross out marketing survey and put design doc.
I hope someone doesn't just quote that because they're mad and just pick some. Yeah.
They probably will.
Yeah, they will.
Inevitably.
Farwolf!
It just gets a section of downloads because then we say you have to download the actual podcast now. I like that I'm pointing at the recording device that we're recording it on.
David gesticulates at things in audio recordings.
And then he mentions the fact that he's gesticulating.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's important.
Very visual.
Feel like you're a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
It's empathy. Yeah. So, Jamie, I honestly could talk hours and hours and hours.
No, we got to have him back. Stuff. Jamie, we want you to commit to coming back for another podcast.
Sure.
We're only about a quarter of the way done.
Sure. You know, I may survive if I admit this, but I have all the original Halo 1 design documents.
Oh, you said that earlier.
That we could go through and laugh at.
Yeah. So I just want to thank you so much for coming on, and we absolutely would love to have you back.
Is there anything Sucker Punch related you want to pimp while you're here?
Oh, nothing that I'm – yeah, nothing. I'm really enjoying my time at Sucker Punch. It's it reminds me a lot of Bungie back in the days when we were making Halo 1. So
my buddy Colin just started there as a community manager.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so but nothing that we're working on – that I'm working on is anywhere near being ready to talk about.
We'll come back on when it's ready and come
absolutely.
Back on before.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, and we'll see you next week. Hopefully you can come by for Halo Fest. Or sorry, I'm saying next week, but by the time you're listening to this, probably already there. But you know, hopefully you can come by for Halo Fest sometime next week during PAX
stuff,
as well.
Sign boobs.
Just come and hang out, quite honestly.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Frank will lift his shirt. You can sign his.
Oh. There's a tattoo there already. I should mention I've got a website where I've been writing just kind of random design stuff now that I'm kind of free and clear. It's called thetipofthespear.com. Not spear.
Sphere as in a spheroid, spherical.
Too clever globe. By half.
Yeah. And people can also find you on Twitter. That's your Twitter name as well?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Jamie, thanks for coming on, and hopefully we'll have you on again. This was fun.
All right, great. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.